Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Yeah, welcome everybody to the NIDS View, your exclusive and needed deterrence focused podcast. And I say you need it because deterrence is needed in order to keep peace and prosperity. And that's what we're all about. I'm Jim Petrosky, president and co-founder and your host. And I'm joined by the vice president for education of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies and co-founder, my good friend, Curtis McGiffin. Glad to have you here today, Curtis. Let's get started. What do you think?
Good morning, Jim. Let's go.
Yeah, well, first of all, before we start, I have to admit, if you're on YouTube, you'll see that Curtis is wearing a sweatshirt. I'm wearing an overshirt. It's cold here in Ohio. I'm just going to let you
Tennessee.
Know. And in Tennessee. Yeah, and in Tennessee, they said there was some sort of a bomb cyclone coming, but I keep looking out the window, saw no bombs coming along, so I don't know what's going on. So that's part of our process here. So today we're going to discuss something. We've been hitting on a few subjects. They're sort of on the edges of deterrence, and you start to find out that nearly everything has some sort of deterrence flavor. That's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about an article that came out and some information that came out, and it's actually about some U.S. companies as well. But in China, they're building a new hypersonic glide vehicle at an extremely low cost by using concrete as an outer surface for the hypersonic glide vehicles. And the whole objective there, at least what appears to be from this private company, is to build hypersonic glide vehicles, low cost, and manufacture them very quickly. And that was the objective here, using not only concrete as the exterior, but also using commercial off-the-shelf components, et cetera. And that's an interesting concept. And we think that it has a lot to do with deterrence. So if you haven't tied that together, Curtis is going to open us up by starting to make those connections for you. Curtis, I'm going to turn it over to you to start out. You pick the article. Go ahead.
Well, thanks, Jim. I think, this article was released here over the last couple of days here, late November, early December of 2025. And there's some different articles have these different titles. One of them here is that came out on The Sun, which is a British posting here from Shelby Brooks. Coming storm. China unveils, quote, dirt cheap, unquote, missile made from concrete that costs less than a luxury car. And President Xi's eyes overwhelming Taiwan. Hypersonic glide vehicles produced by a private aerospace firm are 40 times cheaper than U.S. equivalent weapons. And some of the other headlines sort of follow along the idea. This is a new missile that is supposedly a hypersonic hypersonic glide vehicle ranging Mach 5 to Mach 7. It was produced by a Beijing aerospace company called Lingkong Tianjin, which is supposedly the system marks the first time that a non-military business within China has produced a weapon for the Chinese government. I'm not sure such an animal ever existed in China, a company that isn't affiliated with the PLA, but that's interesting if true. It's called the YKJ-1000, and it's reportedly costs $99,000 per unit. I believe that is for the quote-unquote dumb version. They are working, that the Chinese are also working on an upgraded version of this system that will include AI, and sensors will allow it to do swarming activity and these sorts of things. Pretty nasty. There was a promotional video that was released on their WeChat channel, which is China's version of social media that you can only get over there. But the video migrated its way. If you've watched the video, I've watched it a couple of times. It's very interesting. It's well produced. It shows this missile system in a container, like in a giant shipping container, and it rises out of the container and obviously launches. They show this missile actually being fired and shot and flying. They show some detonations. We're supposed to assume that they are the same system. And then it's mixed in with a lot of CGI cartoons that show this missile sort of coming over what presumably is a U.S. carrier battle group, sort of flying around that group, deciding which way it wants to attack the which ship, and then penetrating sort of, if you can imagine, a giant dome over the group, over the carrier battle group, and it penetrates that carrier battle group and does its damage. These missiles are reported to fly for about 360 seconds. What is that? 6 minutes, I think, in my public math.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at Mach 5 or Mach 7, I mean, that's a pretty good distance in a very quick, short amount of time. Hypersonic weapons would be very difficult to intercept. And can, you know, if this is true, would certainly be a large asymmetric problem when we think about it just from economics. And we'll go into this a little deeper here as we move on. I want to mention one last sort of tangential thing with this whole presentation. If you go and watch this video, at the very end of it, it shows an image where a number of these missiles are falling down on a landmass that looks remarkably like Japan. And so while marketing, announcing to the world about this new capability, they also don't hesitate to use it as a strategic message in the middle of a geopolitical dispute between China and Japan, presumably over Taiwan and what Japan has recently talked about and how it might work with its allies should a conflict over Taiwan occur. We've already had a podcast on this here very recently. But again, we see this. This dovetails images, say, when President Putin delivered a speech to his Duma in 2018. He talked about when he announced all the novel new weapons. And there's an image he shows in his own presentation where a number of warheads are falling on a landmass that looked remarkably like the Florida Peninsula. So this is an autocratic habit of visually threatening without words, just using a visual, even if it's a CGI or a cartoon image of missile systems performing a mission over a landmass that unusually looks like an adversary that they are concerned about at the moment. China did this before a couple of years ago. They released a video where they were attacking a landmass that was remarkably looked a lot like Guam. So this is not new, but it is, what's the term now? It's not shocking, but it is appalling.
Yeah. Well, you know, Curtis, I think the one thing that I found in this article that you sort of touched on is there's a lot of messaging, deterrence messaging in this article. And even its release is interesting. The other piece I found very interesting with it is the explanation that they're using a company that's outside the CCP. Like, it really,
right.
Like, What does that mean? Are we replicating what happens in the U.S.? Is that what's happening? Is we're going to use, you know, small business? Because, you know, we have an industrial, you know, military Sure. industrial complex that allows for that innovation. Is that saying by the Chinese that maybe we need to bring in more innovation? We need to, you know, innovate outside of our normal operations because the government seems to have, if you will, you know, shrouded this whole business of warfare into one ideology instead of looking out. And now they're starting to look out. It changes the dynamic, in my opinion. It changes the dynamic of how we will suppress any militaristic opportunities by the Chinese. And this is a good example of innovation. By the way, in the U.S., we do the same thing, though. We use our military-industrial complex to look at innovation. I even think, you know, we as an organization, we're a think tank, and we all often will say, you know, we are not part of the government. So we can think outside of the box a little bit and find better ways or maybe optional ways. I won't always say they're better. I will say they're optional ways of looking at things. And when you look at options, I'm an engineer. and a scientist. So I like looking at all the possibilities and bringing in the best. So it does seem to be a change in the, if you will, the government structure, at least the way in which they look at fighting warfare. And we'll talk a little bit about the engineering aspects of this, because I think there's many that this sort of hits on. But that piece about the government tells you that China is looking at other ways of operating that may give them innovations. And certainly in this case here, fast capability to build missiles, hypersonic glide vehicles, and the ability to produce them inexpensively, cheaply, I think dirt cheap. I'm not sure dirt cheap, but I'm just going to throw this at my audience, is that, you know, a $99,000 luxury automobile, I don't know what that is, because I've never, you know, driven or, you know, I think all of my vehicles together, I don't think I do that. So I'm not sure where this writer comes from, where that's a considered typical luxury automobile. I'm just saying. Maybe I'm just cheap. I don't know.
Yes, I think you are. Okay, thank you. there are lots of European automobiles. Remember, this is a British article that are going to broach over $100,000.
Wow!
And you
That's
know,
like in, two houses. In different,
I'm not going to name them because they're not advertising on our.
But they podcast. Could.
They could, and we would be happy to name them. Any case. Yeah, I think what this is, so, you know, what's interesting here, I guess, is the question is, I think, is, are we being out-innovated by an autocracy? We know that they can build stuff faster than we can. This is not a good sign for democratic capitalism, you know, that we mire ourselves in bureaucracy to such a way that it takes forever to build anything in the United States. You know, back in the 50s and 60s, you look at the Century Series fighter aircraft, the F-100 through the F-106, these companies, Convair would and others, McDonnell Douglas did a couple of them, North American did one of the jets, but they would come to the Air Force with, here is a design we have. And then they would even invest and build their own prototype and there'd be a fly off and multiple companies would be competing and these sorts of things. And it was not unheard of to go from concept to blueprint to prototype to operational squadron inside of two and a half years.
Yes.
And today you can't get through the environmental assessments or the bureaucratic assessments on logistical you know flow and whatnot in that time period. It is stymied innovation for sure, and it has definitely hurt us in our ability to do acquisition in a timely manner. And so they're, you know, consequently they're, you know, sort of turning circles inside of us. Now all of this is with the assumption that this stuff works. Okay.
Yeah.
And no. and there's a tendency for a lot of our strategists out there, Jim, to say, well, it's a Chinese weapon system. It probably won't work all the time, or it won't work as advertised, or this or that. I just think that's a very dangerous thought process to assume away that your adversary's weapon systems are not going to work. Therefore, we don't have to address them, deny them, or compete with them. And I think that's a bad thing to do. And I think it's just a mark of an arrogant society. We have to assume that they are investing in workable systems. And you know, you can address the rumors of watered down fuel or, you know, this or that, but let's assume that, you know, one of the easiest things that an autocracy can build is a ballistic system. And they've been doing it for years, and even now they're showing that they have a hypersonic capability that is likely more advanced than ours. So you know, this is not beyond the pale And obviously China is able to build systems cheaper than we can. We've discussed purchase power parity over the years in economics. This is an example of that, by the way. Being able to build any weapon system at $99,000 is a pure example of purchase power parity. But that would only, if you made the purchase power parity adjustment, that would probably only bring that system up to about $400,000 in American exchange rate. So you're still talking about a cheap weapon, because if to the cost to intercept this system, if assuming that intercept would work, like for an SM-6 naval interceptor, is about $4 million a shot. So when you're talking, you're still talking 10 to 1 in an exchange rate cost. And that is, that greatly favors, Jim, the aggressive offense.
So Curtis, I want to repeat something that was said by my dear love of Ronald Reagan. There you go again, Curtis.
There you go again.
Yeah. So and in the show prep, we talked a little bit about this. So oftentimes people misinterpret what engineers and scientists will say when we say, you know, there's a risk involved in doing these things. There's a difference between a risk and understanding the risk and taking the risk. And my old PhD advisor, Jim Howard, if he's listening, thank you for all your help that you did in finishing my doctorate. But he always said one of the problems in getting a doctorate is people are so afraid of failing that they fail. Okay. And it's a rather interesting quote. I wish it was my quote. I have my own quotes. But anyway, that is an interesting
thing. That's a great quote, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. You're so afraid of failing that you fail. And I think we get ourselves into that. But there is, when you build a system without the speed or without a lot of testing, without the with commercial parts, without controlled parts, there's this whole, you know, trusted foundry issue we have right now in the United States, why we have a semiconductor program to build better semiconductors and build them in the United States where we can control them. We have automobiles that are being made. We know this. You can go back and look at what happens. We have automobiles that are made overseas with electronics that were taken out of old electronics, reset into new electronics and called good. And this is why you have multiple recalls on your automobile, because, oh yeah, well, that failed, because we, you know, they're not as good. Now, I understand, Curtis, fully, we cannot assume that these won't work, but there is a risk. There's two risks here, and I'll take both of them. Yours first. There's a risk in assuming they won't work. I absolutely agree with that. But there's also a risk in assuming they will work and they don't from the Chinese side. And we have to, in the United States, find that balance. And I think we're way overbalanced in one direction, like you said. And I absolutely agree with that. I think that, you know, we are so afraid of failing that we fail. Okay. When it takes 30 years longer to put a hole in the ground for a missile system than it did 40 years ago with less technology and less capability, there's something wrong with the system. So I'm not disagreeing with you, but there still is a risk in doing this. And what China has done is they said, we will take the risk of putting many, many more missiles on you that we believe will work. They obviously do. I didn't see, by the way, I was looking at it, the YKJ-1000. Mm-hmm. If that was a U.S. system, it would be a YKJ-1000.3.0.7, right? Because we'd keep adding in changes to it. I think one of the things that China has done is they define the requirement and then they run with it. And that's good. And they get things out there. But there are many things, you know, benefits to them is you can do mass production, you can saturate your adversary, you can save the cost to put that into other things, you can speed up the process of doing that, you can surge your capability quickly, because if you can build something quickly, you can build the industry quickly, and the U.S. slows it down in every step. We slow our industry, we slow our production, we slow our education to be able to get people in there. We slow. We've got to get out of that, because we are a country that can, and we've seen this in the past, we can rise to the capability and do things quicker, faster, and more innovative. And sometimes we have to take a risk, and there are real risks. Now, I'm sort of curious about your comment on this, and we're going to get into U.S. companies in a second here. But I find it interesting that when people talk about cost and efficiency, and you've done this work, Curtis, because I've seen you in the classroom and doing this work, is going back to nuclear weapons. We can actually have highly scrutinized nuclear weapons and still get them out cheaper than conventional weapons by just using our nuclear capabilities themselves. But we never do that cost effective. It's like, well, cost effective here. Ooh, fear. You know, China's putting out many weapons. But we can put out the same kilotonnage at fractions of the cost of the conventional weapons. And so sometimes the innovation is where the technical innovation comes in, or the targeting innovation comes in. And I think as an engineer, my answer is, let's look at everything and let's take the best of what's there. If the best is using commercial off the shelf, like we're doing with some satellites, by the way, or a lower flying satellite that doesn't have to have the radiation survivability built into it, and they're going to fly for only 2-3 years, but we're going to replace them with newer technology in 2 and 3 years, and they're cheaper to get out, say a tenth of the cost of a large satellite that's flying high, then we can do that. These are the things that we need to do, but we can't just simply stick our nose in the ground and say there's only one way of doing it, and that's the system that we've built over the past 30 years that has really hampered our innovation. Our innovators, I can tell you, people are so frustrated that I talk to that are young and have ideas and say, well, it gets killed right away. You can't do that because, well, we never did it before. And we and we fail because we're afraid to take the risk. It looks like China's willing to take the risk and building the systems. And I agree with you. We can't assume they're not going to work. But again, you can't argue that they're taking a risk. But it's a risk they're willing to take, and it's not a bad one, because they get the benefit of putting many, many things out there, even if one or two wouldn't work.
Well, ironically, you know, as a democracy, a capitalist democracy, we punished risk.
Yeah.
Over the years, it may be less so now, but back in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, companies who were funded by, who had a government funding, either like through a military contract or something, would not test a system until it was deemed perfected, right? And because if the test fails, the risk was you have your funding cut.
Yep.
It doesn't work. We can't afford you anymore. You're done. And so what happened was is that tests would be delayed and delayed and delayed. And the problem is we forgot that testing and failing is incredibly important in the innovation process. And then I would add another thing to that is that we have forgotten the value of simplicity. We make things way too complex. A lot of our failure to actually bring things to fruition is, as you mentioned, the decimal points after the 1,000, because we change requirements, we change expectations, we add on mission creep, and all of a sudden, what was originally a single purpose, simple system that was affordable and achievable in a reasonable amount of time has now been so complex. It's a Pentagon Wars, if you ever go watch that movie. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you've got something that is so complex, it becomes unaffordable and likely won't work. And meanwhile, you have this gap in capability that you need. And what happens is we tend to just accept this gap. We write it off, right? We say, we'll assume risk. It's a very famous Pentagon term. We'll assume risk. The problem is, if you assume risk long enough, you tell your government overseers, you really don't need this capability.
Yep.
So why are we going to fund it? So this has been a problem in both in the nuclear world and in the non-nuclear world with regard to that. Going back to your question about the expenses, though. So when we look at this, we already know, we've debated this for the last 3 years, Jim.
Yeah.
You know, the cost of the nuclear arsenal is only 6-7% of the DoD budget. We know it is cheaper, right, to have a nuclear arsenal, to be able to wage peace with a nuclear arsenal than it is to try to threaten war with a conventional arsenal. Those are two different versions of deterrence.
Sure.
Okay. And so what I find interesting is that as we develop, as we struggle to spend more money and out-innovate our autocratic competitors in the conventional world, what we end up doing is, I think, finding our own flaws in the whole process, right? How we our mindsets are wrong, our bureaucracy is a hindrance, and then we create, Jim, we create special programs within the DoD to encourage innovation.
Yeah,
and yet the whole system should be encouraged. Off.
Yes.
Yeah, just remove the shackles and you'd have it. But instead, what they do is we have all these shackles and then we're going to create a subset where we're going to test, well, what would we do if we didn't have all the shackles? Yeah. So, just look in the mirror. You'll see the biggest, our worst enemy. What I would argue then is, well, what does this mean in the greater, bigger scheme of things, right? And I would say that when you have an adversary that is able to produce cost effective weapons that are cheaper, that's a cheaper offense that demand that will consume your much more expensive defense. This is the whole drone war all over again, right? So the idea that we're shooting down $500 drones with $1 million missiles, right? This is, you'll hear this all over the place. And I'm sure there's a lot of that going on. I mean, now, to be fair, the United States has done some innovation. There is a system called the APKWS-2, which is laser-guided 2.75-inch aerial rockets. Now, the 2.75-inch aerial rocket, I mean, this is old technology. We've used this since the end of World War II. I mean, these systems.
Very reliable,
but what they did is they took a dumb weapon and they made it smart. They added these different kinds of sensor systems, and then they hung them on jets, and for instance. And all of a sudden, they realized, hey, we can shoot down subsonic, low-flying, not very maneuverable drones. With this much cheaper system, we don't have to fire multi-million-dollar Sidewinder missiles at these things. Let's shoot them down with a small folding fin rocket that has a reasonable guidance capability, whether it be infrared heat seeking or some sort of laser guided semi-active system. And that has proven to be very effective in the battle against Houthi drones, Iranian drones in the defense of Israel last year, and so forth. That's a big win. That's a pennies on the dollar innovation that I applaud the Department of War. They have figured that out, and so good on them. And we do have innovation going on, right, in our independent, commercial industry here in America.
Military and, industrial complex was the word.
Well,
we
yeah,
for,
it is such a that is such a negative connotation.
That's
right?
A great connotation. We need to have industry.
President Eisenhower sort of,
I know,
hung some shadow on that term, and it's like this beast. The arsenal of democracy, maybe a better way to describe it. But there's American companies now that are looking to build lower cost capabilities. They're not a sponsor of this program, but we'll give props where they should. There's a company called Andrew Industries. They're working on what's called the Barracuda family of cruise missiles. It's purported to utilize commercial off the shelf capabilities and some other innovative techniques that they say will be about 30% less than its counterparts in the Western arsenal, and that's some savings. I think that's a great
savings
start.
All
savings is good savings, and these systems have supposedly great capabilities. They have different sizes, all the way from small ones to large cargo launched, pallet launch type cruise missiles that could carry warheads, quite frankly, Jim, that might be big enough that could be a bigger boom than a conventional boom.
Yeah.
And they have these cruise missiles have loitering times of measured in hours. But this is not a hypersonic response, right? If we're trying to match hypersonic, right, it's an asymmetric response. So we're going to give it with, we'll replace speed with loitering time. and these sorts of things. So there are different mechanisms in which to think about this. So I applaud industry who are out there doing that. But this is a tremendous challenge, and that we have to consider.
Yeah, I do. First of all, regarding what our adversaries or any innovator does, I want to remind you, since I quoted my thesis advisor, Jim Howard, I want to also quote myself, because I can't find anyone else has quoted this, but my favorite quote in this is always, never underestimate your adversary's low-tech solution to your high-tech problem.
That's right.
Okay, and we see that, but we do need to look, I think we need in our education system to look at, you know, we've gotten away from the grassroots, you know, I'm a farmer, you know, I come from a farming community, but oftentimes you start looking at what's the solution, what's the low tech solution to get there. And I'm not talking that everything has to, you know, we're not going to be throwing rocks at each other. Hopefully we're not getting to that point. But my point is that you've got to teach people from the bottom up, and then you've got to educate them and give them the ability to maneuver in that space and apply that to places. It looks like this company has done that. In fact, they are, what are they, Anduril Industries, if I remember. And I looked into this for another reason, because they're opening here in Ohio, or at least they're looking at building a system here in Columbus, Ohio, is that they have looked at other technologies, to include hypersonic boosters and solid rocket motors. They've looked outside of the realm, but they're using this low cost capability to do this. And any cost savings is good in building systems here within the United States. And I think that's part of the industrial complex. I won't call it the military industrial complex. I don't want to hurt your feelings, Curtis. But I'll
call
it
my feelings.
but building U.S. industry and applying our capabilities here in the United States is so important, so we're not reliant on other people. But we have to take an approach that allows that innovation to be, one, we're a capitalist society. They have to be able to make money. If we put too many strangleholds on them, too many shackles, as I call them, too many shackles on the process, on the building, on the people, on the industry, on the mapping it out on the ground, we end up having a system in the end that costs so much or is undoable because we don't have the capability. Then we have to go outside. And that, to me, is a problem when we look at deterrence, because our adversaries can take advantage of that. You know, we're up to 31 minutes. So I want to, oftentimes we end here because we run out of time. And before we run out of time, I want to go back to something that I sort of just touched on. So if we're going to change the system, Curtis, what are the touch points that we need to make in order to get the United States back on a footing where we are innovative, keeping up with our adversaries? I mean, you know, that I jokingly said this to you, I think on a podcast, three podcasts ago, we were talking about costs, saying, so you think the Chinese government is better than U.S. government because they can build things faster. And I don't think that's what you were saying, but I thought I'd throw that out there. So if we're not going to be an autocracy, but we still want to use our capitalist system, where do we start? How do we fix the system?
Well, that's a complicated answer that I'm not going to be able to answer for you in the next couple of minutes. Instead, let me tell you why we have to fix the system.
Okay.
So let's look at that. So when we look at the idea that our adversaries can innovate these cheaper weapon systems, this is purchase power parity, the fact that they may well be outspending us. Yes, American listeners, I'm thinking that they are outspending us. When you can build weapons at a tenth the cost, you can amass them and overwhelm us with our defenses, which cost, right, 90%, 90 times greater. We can be outspent very quickly. And it is a form of economic warfare. And it's extremely destabilizing when you can do this. Cheaper weapons can often be deemed more usable. They favor the attacker, especially an aggressive attacker, and it can erode deterrence because it favors this sort of aggression, sort of a smoke them if you got them, Jim. And you can saturate defenses, which can be costly for democracies, Western democracies, who invest in these high-tech defenses because they have this sort of they hope that they can repel and deter the risks of a strategic attack of using higher tech, so like ballistic missiles and other things. And you know, Golden Dome is sort of going to wrestle with this. We're going to spend a ton of money on Golden Dome to intercept missiles that are arguably going to be much cheaper than the Defenders, because the cost of defense is very expensive. What we have to do is you have to find a way to convince the attacker that offense is not going to be less favorable because of the numbers. That's a tough one to do. It does favor poorer actors, these kinds of asymmetric issues. So that is the challenge here. Well, that's all the time we have here today. We had a little technical glitch here at the end, and Jim decided to get on his horse and ride off into the sunset. Well, hope you enjoyed today's presentation, and I encourage you to get out there and read about what our adversaries are doing in the world and why we as Americans need to continue to pursue our aspects and our goals to achieve a successful deterrent effect. So again, thank you, the listener. Be sure to hit us up out there on our website at thinkdeterrence.com. Check out our articles that come out on globalsecurityreview.com. Hit us up on LinkedIn and connect with us. And try to find us on our YouTube videos or Rumble videos as well. We do appreciate you very much. Wishing you a very happy holidays. We always want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.